Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Friday, July the 3rd, day number 182 of 2015. I think we have literally crossed into the second half of 2015, 365 divided by 2, so 182.5. So yes, we're in the second half of 2015, and today we're going to chat with our good friend Frank Burke. We're going to take a look at the Declaration of Independence, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, obviously, there's a lot more than that, but those are the three words, I suppose, that most people can tell you about the Declaration of Independence. We're going to look back at what inspired these amazing men to write this document, why they chose the words life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I have to believe there was a meaning to it. And we'll also remember that on this day in 1826, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson passed away on the 50th anniversary of the Declaration. And then 5 years later, 1831, James Monroe also passed away on this day. I don't remember now, I have to ask Frank, if Monroe was one of the signers of the Declaration, but three presidents who have died on July 4th. I think that's a pretty interesting situation. We're going to take a little break. We're going to hear from our sponsors, and we will be right back. Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. Let's say hello to our good friend Frank Burke. How are you, Frank?
Well, thanks. Well, thanks, Silvio, and yourself.
Absolutely great. Frank, I think we're dedicating this show to everyone who I think, people who have not read the Declaration, people who've read it, children in the future who have not been born yet. I think, you know, we want this show to be a teachable moment, as they like to say. About this amazing document, the Declaration of Independence. But I got to ask you something, because if you wrote a script about a country that was formed and two men who signed the Declaration of Independence died on the 50th anniversary of the Declaration, I think a lot of studios would say, "Come on, that doesn't happen." But yet they did. Jefferson Adams died on July 4th, 1826, and Monroe also died on July 4th. But I don't remember whether he was a signer of the Declaration or not.
No, I don't believe James Monroe was a signer. I think he was involved in the Army at that time.
Yeah, because I did a quick biography of Monroe, and he was only 18. When the Declaration was signed, so he may have been a soldier or a militia man, but probably not old enough to be participating in these proceedings, you know, of the Declaration. But he did serve as President number 5, I believe, and the last president, I believe, to be born in Virginia. The 4 out of the first 5 were Virginians, but. You know, Frank, when you think of the Declaration of Independence, what comes to your mind? I mean, for me, it's life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's that phrase always comes to my mind. How about you?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a if I might, I wanted just to say, when you mentioned about a teaching moment, I would like to say a short hello to my grandson, Ryan, who is going to be 13 in a few days and who is very interested in the American Revolution. So, as you said, this is for the children, it's for the adults, it's a learning experience. But yeah, I think most people think of that phrase, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But I think that over the years, the meaning of the Declaration and why it was so revolutionary and why it's such an angry document has kind of receded because of the verbiage. People just, if you get someone reading it, the language is so antique. They almost always read it in a kind of soft tone voice, which it really should not be read in.
Yes. Well, there is a really interesting video of the reading of the Declaration, of course, a staged video, not the real one, because there was no video back then. But there in the HBO series, John Adams, mm-hmm. they recreate the reading, and somebody actually comes out to the balcony and reads the Declaration. And, you know, I kind of put myself in the place of the men and women who were in that audience that day. First of all, I'm amazed how powerful the voice of the reader was, that, you know, he didn't have a microphone or anything, but yet he could be heard for quite some distance. And I kind of put myself in the place of all those people that day. What I'm hearing that day, if I'm in that audience, I'm hearing something that had never been said before in front of common people, let's just say, that put it that way. Maybe some scholar had read something like that or written something like that, but not common people. So, I mean, they were really in the middle of some rather amazing moment in world history, and I'm wondering whether they realized it. What do you think?
Well, you know, I think they did, and you bring up a great point, Silvio, and that's the fact that when history is taught or read by many people, it's read looking backwards. But if history is to be alive, if we're to really understand it, we have to take it in context, meaning we have to remove ourselves and go back in so far as we can and try and see why, what it was like at the time it occurred, what was going on, what people were thinking. And of course, to me, as we had discussed a little previously, one of the great things about the document is how truly revolutionary it was. And that comes from the fact, if I might explain that, we have to go really far back to ancient history. In 313 AD, the Roman Emperor Constantine was converted to Christianity through a miracle. He saw a cross in the sky, and he defeated a giant rebel force. When he became a Christian, the Western world, what Rome had conquered, became Christianized. Now, in a short time later, less than a century later, Rome fell, and there was a vacuum of authority, and that was picked up by the church. People thought, well, you know, who to rule better than the rule of God? And the vicar of God is the Pope in those days. So, okay, the Pope became a political figure, which caused a lot of problems in a lot of ways. But in order to kind of justify the rule of many of the kings, who all had to kind of answer to the church in one way or another, and in some cases were literally crowned by the Pope personally, a doctrine developed, and that was called the divine right of kings. That meant that the king had been appointed really through God. God controls everything. Therefore, if you're a king, it's because God wants you to be a king. And so you have a tremendous right to rule almost in the name of God, hence the divine right of kings. Even when there were rebellions, such as we're celebrating this year the 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta, Prince John's barons had to go to him and ask him to grant them additional rights. Those rights came through the king. The motto of the British royal family in French is, if I may be mispronouncing this, Dieu est mon droit, which means God and my right. So here's this group of upstarts in the United States, and they produce a document that says, among other things, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just right from the consent of the governed. And in that, and going on and saying before that, saying we hold these truths to be self-evident. They didn't come from anywhere. They're obvious. That all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So you were looking at a document that is revolutionary. We don't need the king. We're not only saying, England, go away. We're saying the king has no power here.
Right.
Because our rights come from God.
Now, the idea, this has always been so interesting to me. I'm sure that these were, you know, very talented men who chose their words very carefully. One of the things that amazes me about those early documents is how brief they were compared to some of the stuff. You know, Obamacare is 2,000 pages, and the Declaration of Independence is like one page long, you know. You know, it is amazing, you know.
I can tell you which will last longer, too.
I agree. We're certainly hoping that the Declaration lasts longer. You sometimes wonder. But anyway, what I'm getting at is the words life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Yes.
Life, I mean, these three things had a meaning to them. They didn't just choose them out of the air. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the one that has always really amazed me is the pursuit of happiness. I mean, what a concept that you have a right to live. You have a right to be free, and to pursue your happiness. I'm assuming by that they meant not just that, you know, your hobby, but your profession, your desires, that you could choose to be whatever you wanted to be, you know, in the context, of course, of a civil society. So I'm fascinated. Explain those words: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. What do they mean to you? I should say.
Well, to me, of course, life is self-evident. It means that every person is entitled to their life. You cannot circumscribe their life. They are not bound into something. For instance, in Europe, if you were born a peasant, you stayed a peasant. That was your life. It was circumscribed. And to say life is to say you are entitled to that. Nobody can take that away from you unjustly. You know, the king could call for people to be killed. You had many instances of that. And they're saying, no, that's out the window. You are entitled to your life. Liberty, of course, the ability to pursue what you wanted to pursue, the ability to be free from onerous laws, to be free from unreasonable searches. We've just had the government declare that whole NSA thing, which invaded our privacy, as illegal. We are freed from that. Because we have a constitution that guarantees us against unreasonable search and seizure. So that's liberty. And happiness in the context of that time meant the ability to live a full, useful, and rounded life. That there's the implication in that of a life of service. It's a life well lived. That's what produces happiness. They were not talking about good times. They did not foresee video games.
Right, exactly. Or yeah, you're right. Or your favorite television show, or whatever. Although you could, if watching maybe a good theatrical performance was your pursuit of happiness, they had no objection to that, I assume.
No.
I just find it remarkable because, you know, over the years we've tried to obviously, you know, bring those words to the present And do you think that obviously they were not thinking about life, like when we say you're pro-life or something regarding abortion, they weren't thinking about abortion back then. But do you think that by life they meant the unborn as well? Could that have been an idea or something? Would the word life in the Declaration of Independence mean the unborn as well?
Well, I don't think they were thinking about it, but I think it is extendable to that. And that's probably the soul of a great idea, that it's articulated in its time, but it has meaning way down the road. And I think one could take that to mean that, yes, there is if you are alive, you have a right to that life. And that is that you could make a case for that.
Let me ask you another question. These were very very smart men, most of them landowners, most of them educated, certainly much more so than the average person in the colonies at the time. We're celebrating 239 years of this document. How many of them do you believe thought that they're writing a document that would last 239 years? I mean, if I said to one of them back then, you know, people will be celebrating this 239 years from now, what do you think their reaction would have been?
I think they would have said, "I hope so, sir."
Yes, I think so.
I don't think they would have been definitely sure. Because they had seen the rise and fall of many things in their time. They themselves were participants in a revolution that was bringing about great change. And so there would have been an amount of doubt, but I think the doubt would have been outweighed by their hope and by their optimism and by their faith in what they were doing as a nation.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that there's a great story about Samuel Adams from Boston, and more than a beer. He owned a brewery for a very short time. But Samuel Adams, at a point in time during the Revolution when things were going really badly, the people in the Congress started talking about, well, do you think it's too late? Could we make peace with the king? Should we send a peace overture? And Adams stood up and said, you know, we will win. God wants this. What we are saying is the will of God, and you cannot defeat that. So don't even think about losing, because you can't. You have God on your side. And that's how much it meant to him. That's what he believed. And I think it was that kind of faith in God, but also faith in what they were doing, that enabled these people to come through a time that was very, very difficult. And, you know, they were human too. George Washington had to fight all kinds of opposition in the government. He was accused of many things. It was a very tough time. But there was faith.
Right. One thing that has always impressed me about this declaration, Frank, is at the end of the document, they all pledge their lives or honor. I mean, it's like they were saying, hey, I'm betting my life on this.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, that is really, I don't know how historic that is. I mean, it happened in other documents, but certainly it was a high risk, because they really knew what that meant. If we fail, we're dead. I mean,
yes,
that's about as simple as that. And even though they succeeded, many of them suffered great losses during the war, Frank.
Yes, they did. And I think you make a great point, and it was articulated well by Benjamin Franklin, who said to them, "Gentlemen, we must hang together, or to be sure, we will hang separately."
Yeah. I think I have there have been variations of that topic, right? United we stand, divided we fall.
Mm-hmm.
Over time, yeah. Now, you also told me the story of what Ben Franklin said to a colonial about the Republic. I used to say that off the air, if you could remember that story.
Sure. And this was as the Constitution was being written and developed. He came out of a session one day, and he was approached by a woman who said to him, "Mr. Franklin, can you tell me what kind of government have you given us?" And his response was, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it."
Hmm.
And that has a lot of meaning today.
Yes, I would think so. And how confident, I mean, Ben Franklin was much older than most of the other signers. I know that Jefferson was in his early 30s. I'm assuming Adams was maybe in his mid to late 40s. Washington, I think, in his 50s. But Adams was, I mean, Franklin was, I believe, a lot older and probably much wiser, too. He had seen a lot of the world. But how confident, I mean, if you could take a guess, how confident do you think Franklin felt that lady would keep it?
You know, I think Franklin, if you read his autobiography, he really understood a lot about human nature. And he had a lot of friends in England. He had friends among some of the most influential people in England, because in addition to being a politician, he was a scientist. He was a writer. He was so many things. He was probably the brightest of all the men of that period who were involved in the founding. And I think that's why he put that caution in. He knew what we were trying to do, but I think he might have been skeptical. You know, he made a comment one time, and I'm paraphrasing it, that if there comes a time when a larger class of people can, in effect, tax the wealth of the upper classes of the wealthier people to their own benefit, then the whole system will fall apart. And you look at the drives for so-called income equality now.
Right.
And you're seeing what Franklin said come true.
Right. Well, you're seeing it in Greece. You're seeing
yes.
it in Greece right now. I mean, that's exactly what he was talking about. Frank, if you were telling a young person, high school, you went to a high school history class, and some 16-17-year-old kid raised his hand and said, "Mr. Burke, that's really interesting what you're saying, but what does that mean to me in the 2015? I mean, these men were alive in 1776, and, you know, I'm 2015, and I've got bigger problems than they do, and this, what would you say to that young man?"
I would say that you really need, you know, that it's always said, it's very hackneyed, people have said it a lot. George Santayana, the philosopher, American philosopher, once said, "Those who fail to heed the lessons of history are condemned to relive them." And unless you're willing to study history and retain that knowledge and see how things happened, see what worked and see what didn't work, you're going into life blind, and you can become the tool of men who are and women who have bad purposes toward the country and who want to take what you have. Ronald Reagan said it beautifully. He said once, freedom is never more than a generation away from extinction. And he was right.
That's right. Frank, let me take a little break. I want to hear from some sponsors. And then when we come back, I've got a couple of fun questions for you. This is Silk Council in Dallas, and we're talking to Frank Burke about the Declaration of Independence. is Silvio Cantu in Dallas, Texas. Frank Burke, our good friend, is joining us. We're looking back at this amazing document, the Declaration of Independence. I do have one quick question. I want to go back to Ben Franklin for a second, Frank, because you said that he had many friends overseas, and I'm sure he did. I'm sure he did. But what fascinates me about that, and I'm thinking in the context of 2015, you know, I talk to my friends instantly, like I'm with you. But back then, you know, it could be weeks before letters went back and forth across the Atlantic. So, I mean, it must today I can share a problem with you or talk to you about something on the phone. Back then, there were just letters going back. So it's possible that Franklin sent a letter to a friend in Europe, and by the time he got it, the declaration had already been signed. So, I mean, it's just, I don't know how much we appreciate how instant communication is today, Frank.
You're absolutely right, Silvio, and that's quite true. You know, it went on for many years. The Battle of New Orleans was fought after the War of 1812 ended. Only General Jackson didn't get the news.
Well, in that case, it may have been good, right? Because he win that battle.
Yeah, he did.
And that battle led him to the presidency, if I remember. You know, there's a suggestion, Frank, that President Obama should light up the White House red, white, and blue this weekend in a way of bringing the nation together. By the way, I'm not real fond of people lighting up the White House. I like it the way it is, way it is. Just keep it the way it is. There's no sense, you know, using it for political purposes. But since he did a couple of weekend or last weekend, I guess, someone suggested that maybe it should be lit up red, white, and blue as a way of saying those are the colors of the whole nation. What do you think of that?
Well, let's put it this way. I'm with you. I think that what was done there was crass and classless, and I don't think it would help to try and undo it by starting a tradition of lighting the White House. The top of the Empire State Building, fine. That is typically lit, I believe, red, white, and blue on the American holidays. But no, the White House needs its dignity, and I would say the main thing is to keep imparting, especially to our kids, especially to young people and to people who come here, what the message of the Declaration is and why it was the natural precursor to a Constitution that came not through any authority but that of the people, we the people, and based on rights given to us by God, not by anyone else.
Interesting. You know, I sent you an article today that Gallup comes out with a poll every year in which they ask people how proud of your country are. And they ask, are you very proud, extremely proud? And less than half of the youngsters, as we say youngsters of our age, people under 30, something like less than 50% of them are extremely proud of their country. And to me, that's a real challenge because it is you have to keep the young people engaged so that they appreciate documents like this. Because any young man or woman who appreciates a declaration and what you and I have been talking about today, any young person who appreciates or who knows that would be very proud of his country, because he would understand how exceptional his country is and that he should be extremely proud of it. So I get the feeling that maybe we're not teaching correctly the Declaration and we're not teaching the history of the United States correctly so that people are in fact extremely proud of their country, as I am and you are, Frank.
Well, I think you're very right, Silvio, and you and I have talked about this. A big part of, if you will, the dumbing down of the American people has been the fact that history is no longer taught, or it's no longer taught chronologically, meaning in the order in which it happened, because without that understanding, you can't really appreciate what the United States is. There was another instance where it was on TV where a young guy in, I think, San Diego was asking people, why do we celebrate the 4th of July? They didn't know. And another one, another instance where someone was asking, going around soliciting signatures on a petition to ban the American flag. Now, he didn't mean it, but he wanted to see how many people would go for it, and quite a few did. So something's wrong, and what's wrong is the fact that I think many people today are trying to make political hay by saying that we are not exceptional. They think in terms of one world, that everything's equal. I'm sorry, everything isn't equal in this world. And if you don't believe that, go to one of the countries where there are revolutions and, private armies. Visit Nigeria. That would actually, don't visit Nigeria or Zimbabwe.
You'll
appreciate America.
Sure. You don't even have to go extreme cases like Zimbabwe or Nigeria. There's a lot of countries in between, much, much better off. But I think what exceptionalism, American exceptionalism, has meant to me, it doesn't mean that the United States is better or that people born in the United States are better than people born in France or Yugoslavia or whatever. It simply means that there's something unique. That's the way I look at it, that there's something unique about the birth of the United States, what we talked about, the idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. There's no other country that was formed like that. There's no other country that you could have gone to in the 19th century or in the 20th century, like my parents, from another country, and come here as some of these immigrants did without much of a chance back home. And yet they could come here and start a whole life and make something out of themselves. That's exceptional. That hasn't really happened in other countries. So that's what it means to me. It doesn't mean that we're better or that we should look down at people. It simply means that there's something very unique about the American experience. Rush Limbaugh said something a couple of weeks ago that this whole thing was almost a miracle, that when you think about it, it almost didn't happen. The Declaration and the Constitution, the whole idea of nationhood, and had it not been for a few men who said, no, we're going to stick it out, we have to stick it out, the whole thing could have just fallen apart and we'd be, I don't know, like Canada maybe today or Australia,
yeah,
or something like that. Something, I mean, not bad. I'm not saying it's bad, but certainly not the United States of America that we know, Frank.
Exactly. And we have been able to be that kind of that melting pot, that cauldron out of which so much good came. And I think that's part of it in the American character. There's a tremendous amount of goodness. There's a tremendous amount of concern, even for our enemies. If you look at the way after the Second World War, the Marshall Plan and the rebuilding of Germany, the rebuilding of Japan, the way even we have treated our enemies, our concern for people around the world, I don't think there's another country that shows that to the extent that we do.
Right. And if what makes the American exceptionalism is that we had the resources and yet we were willing to use them to help other people, like you say, the Marshall Plan, the way we helped Japan after the war. So it's a great part of the American spirit. And somehow I don't think this is being communicated to young people. They're being told too many of the things that are wrong in the country's history, and some things went wrong, let's not deny that, but a lot more things went right. And if you look at the balance, you know, the when you take the yellow pad, all the right things, all the wrong things, the right things are many, many more than the bad things. And the amazing thing about the American nation is that even the things that were done bad, for example, like the treatment of blacks, well, that was corrected, I believe, graciously with legislation and opportunities for minorities as they have today. I don't know of too many other countries who've done that, who've said, okay, we made a mistake, we're going to correct it, and we're going to give you opportunities so you can succeed. I don't know too many other countries who've done
exactly
that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No.
Anything else? I was going to go ahead and make your thought there. No, and finish your thought.
I was going to just agreeing with you. I don't think I can't think of too many that did.
No.
For the time.
Any last thoughts about the Declaration that you want to share with us?
Just that it is something that should be taken out and read again, and read in the spirit in which it was written. That when you get toward the end of it, where they're articulating why they want to be separated, all the things King George did to the country that were wrong, read that in a loud voice, because this is an angry document, but a document filled with wisdom, and a document that literally changed the world, and in its thought, in its threat to kings, dictators, and unelected rulers, continues to change the world.
That's right. I was just going to tell one little story. Again, going back to that HBO John Adams series that came out, I think, in 2006 or 2007, I think it was. 2007. It's a fantastic series. Everybody should watch it. It's really good. But there's a scene in that series where John Adams goes to London as a representative of this is after the Articles of Confederation, I think, and he mm-hmm. goes to London as the representative of this new nation over in North America, and he comes to present his credentials to the King of England as a diplomat, and it's funny to watch, because here you have the King accepting the diplomatic credentials of John Adams, and the King is looking at him saying, you're the guys who were questioning my royalty. And it's an interesting scene, you know, the two of them, these two men who had fought against each other, not just on the battlefield, but philosophically. It's a very interesting scene, and I'm sure the people who've seen the series are familiar with it. Frank, wonderful, happy 4th, happy July 4th, my best
and
to you.
And
And I hope that we're going to do that. We're going to make this into an annual tradition. How's that?
That sounds absolutely great.
All right.
There's lots to talk about.
yes, I'm sure next year we'll find something totally different. Have a wonderful July 4th, Frank.
And you too, Silvio. God bless the family. God bless the audience. And God bless America.
All right. That's exactly right. God bless America. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. What an amazing document it was. This is Silvio Canto. My thanks to my good friend Frank Burke, and we'll talk to you later.